Golf Smarter Premium number 552, published on August 9, 2016, is brought to you by Golf Overnight. If you're about to take a vacation or a golf trip, don't have your clubs slow you down. This trip, have your golf clubs waiting for you, not the other way around. Save 20% on your next shipment when you use our exclusive promo code GSMART. That's G-S-M-A-R-T to save 20% at golfovernight.com. And stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear the last announcement for you to enter and win a brand new high heat 3-wood from Knuth Golf. We'll announce the winner in our next episode. Golf inconsistency sucks. Let's learn about the impact zone with Bobby Clampett.
This is Golf Smarter Premium. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome to the Golf Smarter Podcast, Bobby.
Hey, good to be with you, Fred.
It's great to have you on the show. I appreciate so much you agreeing to come on. And we have something exciting to promote, and we'll do that later on the show. But I wanted to talk about a number of things. I have a long list of things that hopefully we can cover today. But let's start with, you have a phenomenal history. It's very exciting to read about it and to know about your game. And if you followed the game for a long time, you definitely know who Bobby Clampett is. Why don't we start with your greatest influence?
The people who were my big influencers, it has to go right back to Lee Martin, who got me started playing the game at the age of 10. Lee's still alive and teaching down in Camarillo, California. God bless him. Ben Doyle, another prominent instructor of mine that took over after Lee went out of state to accept a job. And then, Wally Goodwin in high school, who was my high school coach, who mentored Tiger Woods at Stanford. Carl Tucker, my longtime golf coach at Brigham Young University. And a number of Turing pros, the likes of Johnny Miller, who was like my big brother when I was in college and first few years on tour. Just so many of them, Jack Nicklaus, Arnold Palmer, and a lot of opportunities to be with them. And then, of course, 15 years at CBS with Ken Venturi.
Mm.
And getting to spend that time with Kenny, who grew up in the Bay Area, and his claim to fame was he was the only one in history of golf who had Byron Nelson and Ben Hogan as his two golf instructors.
Wow.
So I would say those have been the most influential people. I'm probably forgetting a few, I'm sure, but just off the top of my head, those are the ones that come to mind first.
So you're a West Coast kid. You grew up in the on the West Coast of California, right?
Yep.
And
yep.
You mentioned a couple
Beach, Carmel.
Yeah, and you're still there, which is pretty awesome.
Yes,
and you mentioned a couple people, Ken Venturi, Johnny Miller. What is it about the Bay Area and golf that is so rich and puts out such phenomenal golfers?
Well, you know, as a kid, I grew up in San Francisco until I was 7 years of age and moved to the Monterey Peninsula with my family. But I can remember my first memory of anything having to do with golf. We were social members of the Olympic Club in San Francisco, and we used to go there to play. My stepdad would go there to work out. And at the end of the day, we would take a family walk out onto the Olympic Club golf course after the golfers were done. And I just thought it was so cool. I'd never seen a golf ball hit before, and I'm watching these people hit this ball way up in the air through those beautiful pine trees and cypress trees. And it reminded me of being at Golden Gate Park, which was my favorite park in the world, still is.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, man, that would be so cool to be able to do that. And lo and behold, a few years later, more than a few years, when I was 10, I had the opportunity to learn the game and never went away from it again.
Mm. It's a love affair that can go an entire lifetime.
Yeah, it is. And you look at the Bay Area, you come down here to Monterey and Pebble Beach, and it's really unlike anything in the world of golf. The courses are so unique. The landscape is so unique. And how can you not fall in love with a game when you have the opportunity to grow up playing these great courses?
Yeah. What about those courses up in the Portland area, like the Bandon Dunes? How do you what do you think about those courses and what they've done to American golf?
Yeah, well, we've never played a tournament up there, and the Champions Tour unfortunately never got up there, so I was busy playing that tour for the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so still to this day, I haven't been up to Bandon Dunes.
Oh,
I've heard
haven't.
A lot about it and would love to get up there, and one of these days I will.
Well, when you do, make sure you play the nine-hole course.
Yeah, that's what I hear. I hear there's some terrific courses.
Yeah, the nine-hole, it was like the most fun on nine holes I've ever had. One of the names that you mentioned there, Ben Doyle.
Mm-hmm.
Give me a little more about Ben Doyle.
Yeah, well, so Ben and I got together when I was 13 years old. I was an 8 handicap, so I'd been playing for 4 years already. And Ben was the first authorized instructor of the Golfing Machine, a book that was written by the late Homer Kelly, who was a Boeing physicist up in the Seattle, Washington area. And Homer had introduced the golfing world to what many consider to be the most complicated golf book ever written, a book that explained all the physics and geometry of the golf swing and then divided the golf swing into 24 component parts and about 15 variations of each component part. And as Ben Doyle would say, over a trillion different combinations of styles of swings, which today instructors around the world are still arguing as to what's the best style of swing to have. But really, Homer's essence behind it all, and my take on it, was that there are a lot of ways to there are a lot of different styles out there, but the most important part of any instruction or the whole essence of the game of golf is about delivering the club into impact. And all the best players in the world do it a particular way. The amateurs in the game do it very differently. And that's what I focus on my instruction, is how to teach tour-like impact to individuals who struggle with the game. And it really has become the answer to how to improve your game. And it gets rid of all the enigmas and mysteries of the game that have plagued golf instruction for literally decades.
And you come from television. I have to prepare you for podcast world. You can talk as long as you want. I know in TV you've got about 9 seconds to get your answer in.
Yeah, it's true.
You can elaborate as much as you want on any question that I ask you.
Well, I mean, it's just we can go so many different directions here, can't we?
Yeah, exactly. So I'll steer it this way. So with the Golfing Machine and breaking it down to 24 parts, does that make it too complicated for golf instruction in today's fast-paced, no attention span world?
Well, what I've done is I've differentiated golf instruction into two different sections. Golf has been traditionally taught through what we call style-based instruction. By style-based instruction, I mean like the A swing that David Ledbetter has just produced, or Hank Haney's rotating the club face on the backswing plane, or that flat plane, or Hardy's one-plane swing or two-plane swing, or the stack and tilt movement of style of swing. All these have been style-based types of swings. And what has happened, and even those who teach the Golfing Machine still get wrapped up into what we call stroke patterns of these 24 components and what the proper, in their minds, the proper variation of each component is. And in my life, you know, my world of being a top, well, we didn't have world rankings back and when I was playing my best golf in the late 70s and early 80s. But, you know, I did some pretty good things in the game of golf back then, and in an effort to to get better after I'd lost the British Open and U.S. Opens in 1982 and had chances to win both. I thought, you know, maybe some of these great instructors might have some advice for me that could be beneficial. And I got sucked down a rabbit hole of trying to redo my swing style in a way that wasn't me, and ultimately ruined my game and led me off the tour. And I went into television with CBS Sports and have been there for 25 years. But in that process, I really came across what is the missing part of golf instruction, where golf instruction had gone wrong. As I started to study some of the best players in the world, just this week we had Jim Furyk shoot a 58 and break the all-time record with one of the most unusual styles of swing the game has ever known. We've got Bubba Watson now, who's won two Masters tournaments with a most unusual style of swing. We have flat swings. We have upright swings. We have Dustin Johnson, who just won the U.S. Open with the most ridiculous left wrist position and top of the backswing position the game has ever known. The whole point and this discovery I made was about a little over 10 years ago. And what helped me lead to this discovery it was the help of the BizHub Swing Vision camera that we had at CBS Sports that was very helpful. It allowed me to really isolate what the best players in the game do. This high-definition camera that could shoot up to 70,000 frames a second was like putting the golf swing under a microscope. And I studied all the best players in the game. Lee Trevino is another one. I remember as a child reading a book or an article that Dick Altman wrote about Lee Trevino, and the title of the article was Five Wrongs Make a Miraculous Right. And that was really what typified the essence of golf instruction in my mind, was nobody could understand how Lee Trevino was such a great ball striker. He had this terrible swing. He opened stance. He took the club outside. He was laid off, arched left wrist, and big loop to his swing. And, then Fuzzy Zeller comes along and wins the Masters and the U.S. Open when his nose is practically touching the ground at a dress position in the world's worst posture. And so the realization that I came to was that all these pros have fundamentally the same impact. What they do at impact is virtually the same. How they get there, or their style of swing that gets them there, is quite different. And then I compared that to the way amateurs create impact and noticed that there was a tremendous difference, and the worst golfers had much worse impact than the better amateur golfers. And I went into isolating the variables of that impact, what is it, and breaking it down, introduced something to the teaching world that nobody had ever talked about before, and that was where the swing bottom is, and made a discovery that the turning pros all had a swing bottom approximately 4 inches in front of the center of the golf ball. And for every inch that the amateurs were behind, that 4 inches equated to, on average, 4 strokes per inch. So the more behind their swing bottom got, the worse golfer they were. And it was a straight line approach, men, women alike. And we had sampled about 100 golfers in that report. And I decided to take these discoveries and findings and turn it into a book. So I got my friend Andy Brummer to help me out, and we put together a book called The Impact Zone that came out back in 2007 and introduced the world to what is known today as impact-based instruction. And I had no idea this was going to happen, but it just kind of blossomed into a whole new way of teaching golf and getting golfers to improve. And we started getting a lot of feedback, emails, phone calls from students and teachers alike who wanted to go deeper. And so we started a teacher training and certification program. And we started a DVD series that is on the market today. We now have 9 videos as part of that that's available. And it just continues to grow. We have 120,000 customers now. We have a full world headquarters in Naples, Florida with 14 instructors. We have 2 academies there, an indoor and an outdoor, where we cover every facet of game improvement from club fitting. We have a biomechanics team. We have a mental conditioning team. Everything is traceable and trackable with how we improve impact, and we do just that, isolate the variables and track each person's improvement so we can show them where they're improving or where they're not improving and get them to get better because, quite frankly, golfers' frustration levels is at an all-time high. Mm. And I think it's the number one reason, I call it the silent killer of the game, that's hurting the game. We've lost almost 25% of our golfing population in the last 15 years. We lose 4 million golfers a year that quit the game. We have fewer courses every year. My gosh, I look around here in the Monterey Peninsula, Rancho Cañada, now 36-hole big public facility that's been the staple of public golf on the Monterey Peninsula, is going to close December 31st this year. And more courses are doing this. And the forecast is for this trend to continue. Mm. And I just find that, to the game I love, I find that just disheartening. And so having played the last 5 years on the Champions Tour and making more money in the 5 years that I did in my entire career on the regular tour with more than 4 times as many tournaments, my wife and I decided to retire from competition and focus on helping the game, and most importantly, by helping people understand that golf isn't a mystery or an enigma. It's really a pretty simple game, but it starts with understanding impact and how to achieve it properly.
How much influence did the success of the Impact Zone have on you deciding to retire?
I think it was more the feedback of people that were influenced by it. We've had literally thousands of testimonials of people who we do golf schools around the country. We have even those who've just bought the video system. My gosh, I've had so many people that have said, I cut my handicap in half just watching the video system.
Wow.
Those kinds of things I know it works. I've heard the stories. I've had countless students who have gone to all the other teachers and worked with them and say, there's nothing like the way you teach. This makes so much sense. It's really all this other stuff of, where's your position and connecting the dots and how many wrinkles in my left wrist at the top, and is my right knee flexed at 14 degrees or 12 degrees? I'm not sure where to go here. It just makes the game so complicated and so unnecessary. When people learn to embrace their own individualism and own style and work on how to create better impact, that's what makes them play better.
It's such a fascinating topic about, the idea of where your divot is in relationship to the ball and how that, where that sits with your handicap. Obviously, those who are behind the ball so many inches, it seems like they're trying to lift the ball up, where those with the divot out in front of the ball, are compressing or coming down on it, and that, hitting the ball, then making the divot.
Right.
Is that where? Go ahead, please.
No, that's exactly it. And when your swing bottom gets at the ball or behind the ball, there's only 2 kinds of shots that you ever can hit, and those are fat and thin. Mm. And so you go around, you hit it thin, and people say, well, I looked up. And then they hit it fat, and they go, I must have lunged into that one. And they just continually go back and forth because they have no margin for error. When the swing bottom gets 4 inches in front of the ball, you have a much greater margin for error. And that's where you have your greatest margin for error. That's why all the touring pros have it there. And so what happens, and that's what's so different about hitting a ball off a tee, is it doesn't have to be that way when hitting the ball off a tee. But off the ground, it's absolutely mandatory. And that's why you have groups of golfers that all they do want to do is hit balls off with drivers. And once they have to hit it off the fairway, they're lost and can't play. And it's just a sad tale. I've played 87 events on the PGA Champions Tour after I turned 50. And in those events, I played about 220 pro-ams, which means almost 1,000 golfers, spending 5 and 6 hours around with almost 1,000 golfers. And to be honest with you, I didn't play with a single one who had even an inkling about cause and effect relationships when they hit a bad shot. They hit a bad shot, and they had no idea why or what to do about it. And we call this assessing and correcting. And they would assess it incorrectly, and then they would make the improper correction if they attempted to, and thus the next shot wouldn't be any better. And so just see this pattern going on, and how many people would say to me, gosh, I guess I'm nervous playing with you. I usually play much better.
Always.
And I just realized, it has nothing to do with their nerves. It has everything to do with their inability to assess and correct. Mm-hmm. And it's so sad. I just cannot tell you how many people have come to my golf schools. We just had one in Columbus, Ohio last week, another one here in Carmel. Week before, we were in Boston, and the week before that, we had one in Florida. And of those students who come and take, and how many of them have been, some of them have been to all the golf schools around. They're like golf school junkies. And they invariably, I've yet to have one that didn't say ours was by far the best experience they ever had. They learn more. They know now, they're clear-headed as to what to do. It's just an epidemic in our golfing culture of we have so many things firing at golfers now. We have so many different media forms from which golfers can get information. You have all over the internet. Then you have the Golf Channel, for example, and you have instruction all over the Golf Channel where Martin Hall is saying one thing, and then Michael Breed is saying something different, and then you have some of the other instructors on there completely contradicting all of them. And then you pick up a Golf Digest or Golf Magazine, and you got the secret tip of the month, and the way that's going to improve your game is the secret move or the new move that everybody's talking about. And then you go to your local teacher and take a lesson from your local teacher who says, no, this is what you need to think about. And everything is style-based. And it leads to such a mass confusion. And the more you get lost in this mass confusion, the worse you get. Your mind is so full of unnecessary thoughts that you can't be free to visualize and see the target and play the game. And it leads to very frustrated golfers and ultimately why we have 4 million that quit every year.
Mm. Not to point at any single person, but there was a lot of overbuilding of golf courses going on. And when I say pointing single person, I look at the Tiger effect of how excited people got about Tiger. And then, people started playing golf, and then Tiger fell from grace, and people stopped playing golf.
Well,
I guess that we didn't have that charismatic character to grab onto.
I don't think it's Tiger's fault, to be honest with you, Fred. I think Clearly, the ratings aren't quite as high on television as when he was playing on a regular basis and winning. But when you look at the trend of what happened with golf, I mean, this actually goes back to the mid-2000s, before Tiger fell from grace, so to speak. And it was... we had had 22 consecutive years of growth in golf. That is, the growth measurement was there were more golf courses than the year before. So golf was in a boom. We did build a lot of golf courses. Maybe we did build a few too many, but they were trying to keep up with the boom. And clearly Tiger coming onto the scene in 97 was a contributor to that boom. But the boom had been going on before Tiger ever stepped onto the tour. So, and many years before that. So that was just adding more fuel to the fire. But then what happened is clearly the economy had a big thing to do with the downturn. But the downturn actually started before the real downfall of the economy. And, you know, the argument was golf was too expensive, it took too long, and the courses were too hard. And
or the game was too hard.
When you look at that, you know, that was what everybody bought into, and still to this day people are buying into that.
Sure.
That's the reason why. But now you've got... a real softening of the golf courses. A lot of the golf courses have gone through redesigns, and they've made them easier and softer. Because of the economy and the way things have gone, many of the memberships are much less expensive than they used to be. I'm just amazed. I was talking to some friends here in Carmel, and I think Quail Lodge and Carmel Valley Ranch, two clubs that used to be both $75,000 to join are now $14,000 to join.
Wow. Oh, I know of clubs. And, I know of clubs here in just north of San Francisco and in the East Bay that if you can pay the monthly, you're in.
Yeah, exactly. And that's rampant all over the country, isn't it? Where, you know, so this argument that golf's too expensive, well, my gosh, it's membership fees have gone way down. And so it's much more affordable than it used to be. I know that, sadly, what's happening is then the quality of the golf goes down. In many cases, the maintenance budgets are much less than they used to be. I know many courses that had maintenance budgets that have been reduced by 50% or more. In Europe, for example, they were narrowing the fairways to just two gang mowers wide. So I think each gang mower was 7 yards. And so the average fairway width was only 14 yards just so they could save money and wouldn't have to mow as much. You know, things like that. They're building, they talk about saving water, which is a good thing, but the less grass they have out there, the less cost they have to maintain it too. So it becomes a financial thing. But, you know, the reality, we talk about the cost. It's really not a valid argument because costs have gone down. Then when you talk about it takes too long, well, it really takes the same amount of time that it always has. So in the years that we had a 22-year boom, the average round of golf took, I think, 4 hours and 36 minutes. It still takes 4 hours and 36 minutes. So I don't know where that argument lands either. And so then the last remaining argument is that the game is too hard. And you talk about the courses being too hard. And there have been some architects that have had a reputation. Pete Dye was making really hard golf courses back in the late 70s. And ever since then, you know, there are a lot of architects that kind of joined that bandwagon, and Nicklaus and Fazio and a lot of them made some very tough golf courses. And I think there is some validity to that. But they kind of blame it on the difficulty of the golf courses, but what I think is really the silent killer of the game is the fact that people are so frustrated and they're not improving and they don't know how to assess and correct their missed shots, and traditional golf instruction isn't helping them. I heard one study of that talked about how in the golf instruction world, 70% of the people who take golf lessons say they either got worse or didn't get any better. Hmm. And that, you know, when they're going to the so-called professionals for help, and, you know, one of the things I'm in discussion with the PGA of America about right now is, and many of other instructors as well, we feel that the PGA should be the leadership of this initiative to help this part of the game. And the PGA does not even have a tract of golf instructors in their organization. They have do a great job of tracking people to be head professionals and understand the business of a pro shop, but they don't even have a track to be a golf instructor. Mm-hmm. So, you know, where are we going in the game? And so we're trying to do our little part to spread the good news that golf isn't a mystery or an enigma anymore, that if you really want to play better golf, you got to make better impact, and we'll show you how to do it.
Oh boy, I have so many things to say now. you know, the thing about the 4 hours and 36 minutes, I don't think it's people are comparing it to what it used to be. I think it's just because of lifestyle in today's lifestyle that the 4 hours and 36 minutes and hitting the balls at, before the round and then sitting at the bar afterwards and maybe sometimes driving an hour, it's an 8 hour day. I just think yep. that makes it complicated.
Well, and true. I mean, the average work week used to be 40 hours a week,
yeah,
too, and
exactly.
Then it got squeezed to maybe closer to 60. So where does that 20 hours come from?
Well, you know, it's not just that. It's that you're never off anymore because of your cell phone, right? Your phone
yeah,
is there. You're on all the time. Your clients can get you. Your boss can get you wherever you are. So,
yep, yep. No, I get it. I think there is some validity to that. It's not that golf is taking any longer to play. It's that Americans today have less disposable time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like the Industrial Revolution created leisure time, and the Information Revolution has stolen it away from us. There is no leisure
right.
time anymore.
Right.
I don't know. I don't know if you saw there was someone wearing a T-shirt back at the PGA Championship. It was red with white writing that said, "Make Tiger Great Again."
Yeah, I did see that. but, you know, I think golf is actually, from a PGA Tour and professional standpoint, is in a pretty good place right now.
Well, we got the Olympics.
Emerging new superstars.
Yeah. Oh, right. The young 20-somethings that are just
yep.
stealing the headlines. And with
Which
golf and the Olympics, I don't know if that's going to help or not.
Yeah. No, I think it will. I think that's going to be good for the game, especially globally.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that when Tiger does return, which I do believe he will return next season, that it's going to create a really interesting dynamic because Tiger's basically been away from the game for 2 years. And having Tiger back in the game could really be something special because if he starts playing well again, now potential new rivalries could
yeah.
develop with Tiger and some of these younger players.
Yeah. Well, more power to you for playing with thousands of amateur golfers at those pro-ams. I know that's part of the job, but it sounds horrendous.
Well, I actually enjoyed it, and
yeah.
I tell you, it really...
You probably learned a lot.
I learned a ton because I learned how they think. I learned what they know or what they don't know or what they think they know that they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And more importantly, how to really help them.
Hmm. So what is it about the impact zone? Is it your body position? Is it where you're focusing your attention on the ground, on the ball? Is it casting versus, you know, is it easy to break it down on why this is successful on being able to get that divot in front of the ball?
Yeah, it is easy to break it down, and that's what our whole DVD system really does. In a nutshell, we teach the five dynamics, which lead to impact like the pros. The dynamics are flat lead wrist at impact, the 4-inch in front swing bottom, loading on the backswing, lagging on the downswing, and delivering the club down a straight plane line. Those are the five dynamics that all the great pros do, and there's discussions about each dynamic that we could get into to break it down more. And then once you have the dynamics, then it becomes a game of consistency of how to recreate it on a regular basis, how to get the ball to meet the center of the club face, how to get the face square at impact, and you're off to the races. So it's really but it starts with the five dynamics. All the assessing and correcting starts with the five dynamics, because that gives you the greatest margin for error from which to play the game. And let's face it, you know, golf is a game of mishits. The average training pro only hits 3 or 4 good shots a round.
Wow.
And so, you know, if you ask them, they'll say, I hit about 3 or 4 good ones today. What'd you shoot? 62, but I only hit 3 or 4 good ones.
That's what I love when you ask people, are you a good golfer? It's like, no one's ever answered that question with yes, except my barber.
Yeah, but... exactly. Depends what you call a good golfer.
Exactly.
You know, was Jim Furyk a good golfer on Saturday? No. He shot 2 over par. He was just about in last place. Was he a good golfer on Sunday? Yes. He set the all-time PGA Tour record for low score for 18 holes. So it's kind of a funny commentary. But
it sure is.
Yeah, but that's how we do it. We break it down. If you have the five dynamics, your misses will be better. Your scores will improve. You'll be happier, and you'll be at a place where you can understand how to assess and correct your miss hits better. And that's what helps take the mystery out of the game. I can't talk enough about, you know, you think about that. I've played with almost 1,000 amateur golfers in the last 6 years, and I hadn't have one that could truly understand cause and effect when they miss hit a shot. And I just noticed golfers play with this, it's a mystery. Every shot's a mystery. Where'd it go? I don't know. It's going to be a mystery wherever it goes. And I used to chuckle with my caddy, because after playing in all these pro-ams, we started a little saying, and I got up there and I said, well, the only thing I care about is that we hit the ball, that the ball goes where we hit it every time. Because if the ball goes where we hit it every time, we'll be happy. Well, of course the ball's going to go where you hit it every time, because you hit it there. but behind that, there's an understanding that you're the one that caused the ball to go where you hit it, and you just got to understand, what was it about the impact that sent the ball there?
Yeah, it's hard enough to teach our kids to take responsibility for their actions. What about golfers?
Yeah, there you go. It truly is, you know, and you see every excuse under the rug, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
You know, I didn't get enough sleep last night, or I think I had too much to drink, or, you know, I haven't been playing enough lately. You know, I only played 14 times last week. I really need to play a little more.
I got to go pound some more balls at the range.
Yeah, I didn't have enough balls in the range. I only hit 500 yesterday to get ready for this. And... oh, you hear every excuse. It's just, it's hilarious.
It really is. Well, that's going to lead me into what brought us together. You're going to be doing a Golfing in the Zone clinic on September 11th and 12th in San Rafael, California at Peacock Gap as part of Michael Murphy's Golf in the Kingdom Marathon.
Right. Well, we became good friends with Michael and Dulcie and have really enjoyed the ITP program that they have. You know, it gets back to my whole philosophy of isolating the variables for game improvement. There really are. Impact is just one of the variables. There are also a lot of variables within that, and they're variables of the short game and putting and all these things. But underlying it all, there's also the mental side of the game and the focus side and the ability to really develop all that visualization, one of the things I really admired about ITP is they're on the cutting edge of a lot of the new technologies. They're not in the box thinkers. They're out of the box thinkers. I like out of the box thinkers. And so we get together once a year, raise some money for the organization, and it's a great time to do some great think tank work, to pull together resources of a lot of great thinkers in the world, and see how we can better this game and better ourselves in the process.
And let me explain to the audience, if they're not familiar with ITP, it's the Integral Transformative Practice, developed, and it's a nonprofit by Michael Murphy, who wrote Golf in the Kingdom. Mm-hmm. And it says in the press release here that it helps to cultivate high performance, creative problem solving, and a balanced approach to daily life.
Yeah, and, you know, the golf is a great vehicle for how we live our lives, isn't it? The way we play the game, the way we go about playing the game is always a reflection of how we go about our daily lives. And as we learn to integrate some of these higher level practices when we're playing the game, we can integrate them back into our lives as well for a more fulfilling and productive life.
Well, yeah, and golf, nothing exposes character like golf.
Exactly.
Once told me on the show, and I've carried it with me forever, is that you don't do business on the golf course. You see if you want to do business with that person on the golf course.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go
you
talk business after the round. But you know, you want to see, does the guy swear? Does he throw his clubs? Does he cheat? Does he have a great attitude about it? Does he not get frustrated? These are the things you want to know whether you want to do business with somebody or not.
Absolutely. No, and it's so true. That's why there are more business gets accomplished out on the golf course than it does in the world of offices.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's so interesting. Yeah. So I got to ask you this one question, if you don't mind. If the 2016 Bobby Clampett could sit down with the 20-year-old Bobby Clampett, what would you tell him?
Don't let anybody change your swing. Let me tell you about your impact when you're playing well, and let's focus on what your swing does to create that impact, and let's keep working on that and refining that, and we don't have to worry about where your positions are, all these different things that all the other instructors want to change in your swing. Don't worry about it. Leave them alone. Be you. And swing your own swing, like Arnold Palmer says.
Hmm. And while you're sitting there with the 19-year-old Bobby Clampett, and you're getting a chance to listen to him as well, what do you think would be one of his greatest concerns?
What would be his greatest concern?
Yeah,
you're
sitting there talking to the young Bobby Clampett, and you're listening to his issues, his concerns. What do you think he'd be talking about?
Probably be saying things like, well, you know, maybe there is answers. If I change my style of swing, I'll be better. And I'll never know unless I give it a try.
Interesting. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Can you share one story from inside the ropes that's one of your favorites?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, it's so many of them.
Oh, go ahead.
I don't even know where to begin.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. About 70 of them just kind of flew through behind my eyes right now.
That's so
the one that just kind of stuck and hit me playing at Bay Hill years ago, or in one of the final groups on Sunday, playing with Tom Watson. He and I had several battles at Royal Troon and at Pebble Beach, British Opens and U.S. Opens, that he won them both. And we're right next to each other in the middle of the fairway on the ninth hole. And we hadn't really developed a relationship yet. It was just this relationship as competitors. And it's so impossible to tell which one is closer to the hole than the other, because they're side by side. The balls are only 6 feet apart, and they're exactly, you can tell, they're exactly the same distance to the flag. So I looked over at Tom as a young 22 or 23-year-old, and I said, Tom, who's out? And he looked right at me with those eyes, and he said, Bobby, it's your shot.
Cold. Oh, man. Well, you know, it's like...
I got a kick out of that.
Yeah, I can imagine. Someone recently said to me, you know, like, I had this lousy putt, and I was still, you know, it was still my shot. And he said, USGA, baby. And I looked at him like, yeah. What? And he goes, you suck. Go again.
That's pretty good. I remember playing with Sam Snead when I was 18 years old in my first Masters. Sam was 65. We teed off the 13th hole. I hit a good drive around the corner, and he didn't miss a fairway that whole day, just down the middle every time. And he turned to me and he goes, that's what I hate about you young kids. I'm hitting a 5-iron to lay up. You're hitting a 5-iron to go for the green. But he meant that with some admiration and affection, too.
And what would he say today about these guys who are not hitting 5-irons to, you know, that they're hitting 8-irons to go for the green after a drive of 350-plus yards?
Well, and how about Bubba 2 years ago on that same hole, after Augusta National bought land in the Augusta Country Club so that they could lengthen the hole by some 40 yards and get it over 500 yards, and Bubba hit driver wedge.
Oh. So what about bifurcation? I mean, really? Do you have any feeling one way or another about bifurcation, about having a set of rules for the tour and have a set of rules for the amateur golfer? Or do we already have that because we play whatever we want?
Well, to some level you do. That's an ongoing challenge, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, the rules are there. They need to be there. They need to be enforced. Do we let people who are over 70 years of age who can't develop enough club head speed, do we let them have a non-conforming driver that can give them an extra 20, 30 yards? I'd like to see that. I think that would be fun. You know, you can't use it in a tournament, but hey, let them go out and have some fun with it. Let them get some extra distance. Or, you know, sometimes the rules get carried out a little far. I remember years ago qualifying for the U.S. Open on a local level. So the first stage of qualifying, I was last off of the last tee time. Driving range was right next to the first tee. I saw the group in front hitting their second shots. I figured I had time for one more drive. I hit my drive, picked up my bag, started walking to the tee. And I was no more than about five steps from the tee when the starter says, on the tee, the 147 tee time. So I shook the hands with my fellow competitors, teed off, and the starter called me over. And I said, yes. He said, you have a two-stroke penalty. I said, for what? He said, you were late for the tee. I said, how was I late for the tee? He said, you did not have your club in hand, ready to play at the moment I announced the tee time. And I said, that's not the way they do it in the U.S. Open. He said, that's the way we do it here in the local qualifier.
Oh, my gosh.
So it preceded a huge argument. The bottom line was I ended up... I shot a 7-under par 65 that day, but with the two-stroke penalty, I ended up with a 67 and had to go into a playoff, which we never could get verification from the USGA in their central office, so they were either going to disqualify me or I had to go into the playoff. I lost the playoff, got an alternate position, went to the regional qualifier in Columbus, Ohio as a first alternate, and was called to the tee for the 7:48 tee time off the first tee. Was just getting ready to tee off when the gentleman who had that tee time slammed the trunk door, came running out with his tennis shoes, and made the tee time. And I didn't get to play. I later found out that the preceding tee time, the 7:39 tee time off the 10th tee, was a gentleman who no-showed. And the second alternate happened to be standing next to the tee, so they took him. And he got to play. So the first alternate, me, did not get to play. The second alternate got in. And so this was all in the same year, by the way. Mm. And so I asked the USGA, I said, you know, you gave away my spot. I was first alternate. You gave it to somebody else. There's only one more qualifier left. You owe it to me to put me in the field. And I'll fly down to Tampa on my own expense, but you need to put me in the field. And they wouldn't do that. They said, we don't do that for alternates. So it's kind of a crazy game sometimes where you talk about the rules and how far they can get carried out. And are rules officials there as Gestapos to call penalties on people? Or are they there to help protect the rules and the integrity of the game, which is the way we always do it in the world of professional golf?
Yeah, there's some folks who take those rules a little too seriously.
Yeah, so it's pretty, it's just interesting how, you know, the USGA is very important to the game and to maintaining the rules. But it's a challenge on how to enforce that and to what extent you do. And you know, typically if a guy is walking up to the tee, for example, and you're getting ready to call the tee time, say, hey, hurry up, you only got about 30 seconds before I'm calling the tee time.
What's wrong with doing that, right?
Yeah, well, in their minds, I asked him that, and he says, well, we don't do that here because if I did that for one person, I have to do it for everybody.
Blah, blah, blah.
I said, you should do it for everybody.
Yeah, exactly.
He ended up calling three penalties on three different people. One guy was talking to his wife in his golf cart beside the first tee when he called the tee time. Gave him a two-stroke penalty.
Oh, my gosh. So at the end of the day, did they have to pull the driver out of a place where the sun don't shine?
Yeah, exactly.
Daly City?
Yeah.
Oh, Bobby, this has been amazing. Oh, thank you so much. One more time, I want to promote the event that you're going to be at. Again, that's going to be September 11th and 12th of 2016. It's Michael Murphy's yep. Golf in the Kingdom Marathon at Peacock Gap in San Rafael, California. And you will be there doing your Golfing in the Zone clinic. And proceeds yep. Benefit ITP International and the Junior Giants, San Francisco yep. Giants charity.
Two great organizations, the ITP and the Junior Giants. So make sure to come out there. If there are any listeners who want to get some work on their game, we have one more remaining golf school this year in Northern California. It's at Silverado in Napa, and it's the 29th and 30th of August. And you can sign up online at impactzonegolf.com.
Very good. Also, yeah. To be a part of the Golf in the Kingdom Marathon, go to itp-international.org/GKM2016. And it's capital G, capital K, capital M, 2016. And also, if you didn't write it down this time, don't worry about it. It's going to be in the show notes of today's episode.
Excellent. Good. Well, we hope to have lots of listeners there and looking forward to having them in my clinic there at Peacock Gap. And it's going to be a lot of fun.
I'm sure it's going to be. Bobby, thank you so much for your time and for being on the Golf Smarter podcast. I know that this audience of one right here, I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Well, likewise. Good to talk to you, Fred. Thanks for all you do to help grow the game, too.
So once again, to learn more about Bobby's teaching method or where you can learn more about the upcoming clinics in your area, go to impactzonegolf.com. And to register for Take two. To register for Michael Murphy's benefit Golf in the Kingdom Marathon at Peacock Gap Golf Course in San Rafael, California, that will take place on September 11 and 12, 2016, go to itp-international.org/GKM2016. Proceeds benefit ITP International and the San Francisco Junior Giants. I will put those URLs, both of them, in today's show notes. So this is our last announcement for you to go to golfsmarter.com for your chance to win a customized high heat 3-wood from Knuth Golf. To register, click on the contest banner on the homepage of golfsmarter.com. Deadline to enter is this coming Sunday, August 14th at midnight. We'll see if we can get Dean Knuth to return on next show to select the winner at random. And while you're signing up to win, make sure that you check out the generous discounts that Knuth Golf is offering Golf Smarter listeners on the new driver, the new 3-wood, and the new hybrid. Now, there's not a ton of time left, so enter today so you could win that brand new 3-wood that will help you get the ball in the air, going straighter and longer. Every time. Questions, comments, suggestions? You know the drill. Click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.